Good morning, Western Wisconsin. Let's see what we're up to. This is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Welcome. It's Thursday, the 14th day of November. This is Spectrum West, where West Wisconsin listens to the people who produce the art, the music, the literature, the theater, and the uplifting stuff that makes living here so special. Today we have some music for you, some ragtime piano, and a documentary film all about players who enthusiastically contend for the title of world's greatest old-time piano player. And it's a very cool production that's premiering in the hometown of some of its producers, Chippewa Falls, this Sunday and Monday. We'll talk with Nick Holly, a Cardinal alum who also co-directed the film. Jerry Poling visits on the phone about his writing career as it pertains to books. He's written about Hank Aaron, Green Bay Packer greats, and now is tackling a lot of history. You'll meet Dave Nachmanoff, a guitar player and songwriter who travels with Al Stewart some of the time and plays solo dates some of the time. It's the latter we'll be enjoying Saturday night at the Heide Center for the Arts. Jim Oliver has a look at what's on stage in Western Wisconsin, and Mr. Oliver is where we begin this voyage of the good ship Spectrum. Jim is our correspondent who specializes in theatrical productions and producers, as well as literary endeavors that touch our lives. Well, Jim digressed from his usual reading fair and soaked up a book designed for young people. That's because it's written by someone with a noteworthy last name who just so happens to have Western Wisconsin roots. This week's opening kickoff is an Oliver Report.
Callista Gingrich is the president of Gingrich Productions. She and her husband, Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, host and produce historical and public policy documentaries. She's a native of Whitehall, Wisconsin, where she was a member of the high school class of 1984. She is the author of three historical books for children, the most recent of which was released in early October. It's called A Yankee Doodle Dandy. Callista Gingrich joins us by telephone from the latest stop on her book tour in Downers Grove, Illinois, near Chicago. So we'll ask her to talk about her books, her other enterprises, and perhaps something about her life in Whitehall. Thanks so much for being with us today. Tell us about your writing. First, when did you get started writing? When did you decide that the writing bug had bitten you for real?
Well, thanks for having me, Jim. I began writing this children's series about 2 years ago, and my new book, Yankee Doodle Dandy, is the third volume in my Ellis the Elephant series. And this is a series that offers a guided tour of American history. And in Yankee Doodle Dandy, Ellis the Elephant, who is my time-traveling pachyderm, discovers the American Revolution and how America became a free and independent nation.
In the publicity information that came ahead of us, talk about trying to make history more interesting for young people, because I think we all understand that a lot of history has been forgotten.
That's right. Well, it's vitally important that our children understand American history, including how our country began and what the first Americans faced. And unfortunately today, many of our children are failing to learn our American history, including our founding principles and values, and instead learning revisionist or politically correct history. And as a consequence, many children today are not learning the basics about our nation, especially about the American Revolution. And as we look at recent surveys, it's really quite sobering. Today, only one in three fourth graders can identify the purpose of the Declaration of Independence. And fewer than half of these fourth graders know why George Washington was an important American leader. So we have some work to do, and we owe it to our kids to give them the tools they need at an early age to begin to appreciate the greatness of this nation.
Now, Yankee Doodle Dandy is about the American Revolution. What are the first two books? What did they focus on?
Yes, well, my first book is called Sweet Land of Liberty. And in Sweet Land of Liberty, Ellis the Elephant discovers the pivotal moments that have made this country exceptional. And in my second book, Land of the Pilgrim's Pride, Ellis discovers colonial America, or how our nation began, which brings us to my third book, Yankee Doodle Dandy, which looks at the American Revolution.
I always enjoyed reading history, whether it be world history, American history, or whatever, but so many of my friends always said they hated history because it was so boring, it's just memorizing dates and that sort of thing. How do you think history could be better taught?
Well, I think in the case of young children, it's helpful to have a unique character to capture their attention. And in my case, I've chosen an elephant, Ellis the elephant. And in writing this series, you know, I knew I needed a unique character, and I considered many animals, including bunnies and hippos and giraffes. But in the end, I could not resist this adorable little elephant, Ellis, who was brought to life beautifully by my illustrator, Susan Arciero.
Now, she has done all of the illustrations in all of your books, which are quite well done, by the way. I really enjoyed the pictures that went with the text in the book.
Yes, she has been my only illustrator, and she is very talented. I'm blessed to work with her, and we have a good partnership.
Now, Yankee Doodle Dandy is written in verse. Now, I haven't seen the first two, so did you write them all in verse?
Yes, they are all in verse, and herein lies the challenge. What we try to do is outline the story we want to tell, highlight the most important elements of whatever it is we are talking about, and also to convey the values that we feel are important, and to do that in two verses in rhyme in each illustration. So that is the challenge, and I usually go through four or five iterations of the text before I come to the final manuscript.
She is Callista Gingrich, who is the author of Yankee Doodle Dandy, the third in a series of historical books for children. Well, what is the age range that you're looking at for Yankee Doodle Dandy?
The age range for my series is technically 4 to 8 years of age. However, my mother, after reading these books, says 4 to 80 is more appropriate. And really, they are very good refreshers. And I have younger children and older children by them. But technically, we're looking at 4 to 8 years old.
You make an issue of including women in the historical narrative. Why do you suppose the role of women was so downplayed in American history for so many years? We all heard about Betsy Ross, and that sort of was the end of it.
That's right. Well, women did indeed play significant roles in winning our freedom. They not only supported our troops, but they actually fought. And in Yankee Doodle Dandy, Ellis meets many important American females, including Martha Washington, who was really vital to the health and well-being of General Washington. He also learns from Abigail Adams, who was not only John Adams' wife and best friend, but really his most influential advisor. He watches as Betsy Ross sews the first American flag. And Ellis also discovers Molly Pitcher, who takes over the cannon when her husband is carried off the battlefield, and she helps to win a decisive battle in the War for Independence. So I feel it's very important for our children, and especially the little girls, to learn that many women did play important roles in the creation of the United States.
You know, that can be tied into current times, I guess, as this is being recorded on Veterans Day, and so many women are left alone with their families while their husbands are off in far-off lands fighting the various wars that our country is involved in. And it struck me as I read about Abigail Adams, who was left alone by her husband when he was off helping build a nation.
That's right. She was left home to care for her family and her property, and at the same time to advise her husband as he was writing the Declaration of Independence. So she really did have a very important role.
Moving on to another topic, your photographs have been published as well. So what came first, the pictures or the prose?
Well, I've always loved photography. And it was actually my first Girl Scout badge, as I recall. My mom gave me a camera at a very early age, and I've always enjoyed it. And Newt and I have worked on projects together that have featured my photography. The one is called a book, Rediscovering God in America, which takes a look at our nation's religious heritage from a historical perspective, and that's done through a walking tour of Washington, going to the monuments and the memorials, and my photography is featured in that book. The second book is Ronald Reagan, Rendezvous with Destiny, which is based on our documentary film, and some of my photos in that book are the photos that we took when we were on location, both in the United States and Europe, filming this documentary film. So I've really enjoyed photography, and I'm always looking for the latest in technology, and I'm always framing an image in my mind. It's just something I've really enjoyed.
Well, one of your high school classmates was quoted in the Eau Claire Leader-Telegram that he was surprised that you became a writer because you were a musician in high school. So what happened to the music?
Well, I'm still very active musically. In college, I was both a piano and French horn major, and I moved out to Washington to work for my hometown congressman right after college. I worked for Steve Gunderson for 7 years, and at that time, I really enjoyed the Hill, and I enjoyed politics, but I knew that my musical side needed to be fed as well. So I immediately auditioned for a choir. I was in the Capitol Hill Choral Society for many years. And in 1996, I auditioned at the Basilica of the National Shrine in Washington and became a member of the chamber choir there. So I'm still active at the Basilica. I sing every Thursday night and every Sunday. I also play French horn with the City of Fairfax Band, which is an ensemble in Fairfax, Virginia. So I've been very blessed to be a part of these organizations. It's a big part of my life, and I really enjoy it.
Well, I'm sure your past music instructors are happy to hear all of that. Tell me about life in Whitehall. Did you live in town? What kind of activities were involved in that city?
I grew up in Whitehall, Wisconsin, which is between La Crosse and Eau Claire. It's a town of about 1,500 people. And in a town that size, you really grow up doing many things. The school is very small, so, you know, all the kids are participating in the various programs. I played volleyball. I played in the band. I sang in the choir. I enjoyed doing forensics. I was a cheerleader. You know, everybody did a little of everything, and I was blessed to participate in so many extracurricular things growing up in Whitehall. But another thing that I really appreciate, having grown up in this beautiful town, it had a sense of patriotism. When I was little, every morning we said the Pledge of Allegiance, and we followed that up with a patriotic song. And I think that really had an important impact on my life as I was growing up. These are people who care about our country, and they want it to be America that we know and love. And I really am grateful for having that opportunity of having grown up in a place like Whitehall, Wisconsin.
We have been visiting with Calista Gingrich. Her book is Yankee Doodle Dandy, the third in a series of children's books that she has written about American history. The book is available in bookstores around Eau Claire and from online booksellers, including GingrichProductions.com. Calista Gingrich, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jim.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, offering full real estate services from listing to selling properties. Current listings, mortgage calculator, and other information is online at wisconsinrealty.org. Support also comes from Simply Done in Downsville, a place for gifts, ideas, and space. Home of Dunn County Pottery, featuring wood-fired pottery in a local and fair trade gallery. Details at simply-dunn.com. And from Water Street Historic District, an eclectic mix of locally owned shops, salons, restaurants, and drinking establishments. Events and refreshments are available at 14 businesses as the annual Water Street Holiday Celebration kicks off this weekend.
Thank you, ma'am. This is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Coming up, we meet guitarist-songwriter Dave Nachmanoff prior to his Saturday date at the Heidi Center in the documentary about the supercharged ragtime piano contest. Here is a Spectrum memo. Saturday at the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee, Power Ballads, the ultimate 80s party at 7:30 p.m. This afternoon, Thursday, you can celebrate the harvest with a free concert by Switchback at the Tainter, 3 to 9:30 p.m. See farm equipment on Main and 2nd Streets, an art exhibit, appetizers, and a cash bar at 6 p.m. Switchback at 7:30. Right now, Jerry Poling and I connect on a regular basis. He as the writer and me as the recipient of the daily news releases and communiques with origins in Menominee, Wisconsin, namely the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Stout, yes. He's a former newspaper sports writer and makes certain his appetite for sports is still satisfied, but he does it by researching and writing books on notable professional athletes like Hank Aaron's time in Eau Claire and the Green Bay Packers of yesteryear. Well, the writing came naturally, but tackling a big writing project takes a lot of planning. Talk about the day that you decided to attempt a project the size of maybe the Aaron book or any of the books that you've written.
The Aaron book, for example, I spent quite a bit of time trying to decide if there was enough material there for a book and doing enough research to make it book-worthy, mm-hmm. I guess mm-hmm. you might say. There were some questions into my mind as to how much material was available. I spent a fair amount of time just trying to decide whether I should do it or not. I think the real genesis for the book was went back to my sports writing days at the Leader-Telegram and then being involved in the Hank Aaron Statue Project. And so I knew there was interesting material there. I felt like there should be a book written, but I still felt as though I needed to do enough research to say, okay, what all is here and is it all worthwhile?
Did you find more than you needed?
I don't think I found a lot more than I needed because it was a little bit hard, especially with the Hank Aaron book, to find a lot of material beyond the newspaper accounts and then beyond interviewing people. And there was a fair amount of that, but there were times when I wished that I had other people available to me to interview. I actually also interviewed former teammates of Aaron's at that time. So, but I think part of me felt like still there was still more information that wasn't available. And as it turned out, after the book came out, I had a few people come forward and say, well, you should have talked to me because I knew this and I knew that. And I said, well, I would have loved to, but you know, there's always that sense as a journalist or as a book researcher, that sort of trepidation that maybe you're not getting everything you should get. And that's always bothered me, even when the books come out. It's like, did I get it all? Did I accurately portray the picture the way it should be? And you only do the best you can at the time. I guess it's just your conscience telling you to keep digging until you think you can't dig anymore.
Take us back to Eau Claire in those days, the Eau Claire Bears, Class C. Now, when I read Class C, I thought, was this really a Class C team, or didn't they have A and AA back then? Or was this really a Class C baseball team?
It really was a Class C team. That was kind of the golden age of minor league baseball. There were a lot more minor league teams around the country then, maybe twice as many or even three times as many as there are now. The Milwaukee Braves had, I think they had two Class C teams, multiple farm teams around the country, many more than they do now, and not just in Wisconsin, but all over the country. So you might think, well, that's a watered-down farm system because there are so many minor league teams, but it actually, the quality of baseball in minor leagues at that time was really unparalleled, I believe, because it was still America's game. You know, just about every young kid that grew up wanted to play professional baseball. So the competition was incredible at the minor league level. So most people believe that Eau Claire's Class C team at that time in the Northern League, that league was comparable to probably Class A ball today. Quality of play was that good.
Henry Aaron is a gentleman, and he speaks courteously in public about most things, including his days in Eau Claire. The movie about Jackie Robinson, 42, gets a bit rough. How does 1952 Eau Claire fare in the nice place to live and play ball category for a young black ball player?
I think Hank had sort of two distinct experiences in Eau Claire, and they got better as they went. His initial experience was really more one of being scared. Now, you think about this, he was 18, and he was still on an extended leave from his first being away from home in his life. And the team he'd played for prior to coming to Eau Claire was an all-black team, the Indianapolis Clowns. So he had never played in front of a white crowd, had never faced a white pitcher, had never had a white teammate in his life. And suddenly he's thrown into all of this completely new situation in Eau Claire, in a city that was farther north than he'd ever been in his life. The first part of his summer, I think the first few weeks, maybe the first month, he was fairly scared of just trying to realize what his boundaries were. You know, he came from Alabama where the Jim Crow laws were still in full force.
Sure.
And I don't think he really knew, you know, if he could walk in certain parts of town, what he could do personally, just in terms of fitting in. So it was an adjustment period that first month for him. And then once he got adjusted and he realized the people from Eau Claire were going to be fair and treat him fairly, and that the manager of the Eau Claire Bears, who, interestingly enough, was from his hometown in Mobile, Alabama, Bill Adair, even though he was a white man, he was going to treat Hank fairly as well. Hank sort of settled in and then started to really relax and enjoy Eau Claire. And he met a lot of nice people, and he would tell you even today that he had friends that he made in Eau Claire that he kept in touch with for years afterward. You know, I think it's almost, you know, I'm not trying to put a positive or rosy spin on something, that he probably had some difficult moments as well. Like he said, he got stared down by white people because he was a black ball player in an all-white city, and he stood out. But overall, he would tell you it was a really good experience. He was treated fairly. There were a lot of young black players and Latino players, whatever, who came to the United States who were not only homesick but were not treated well in places where they played and it ended up going home. But Hank Aaron had a good experience in Eau Claire. He stuck out the whole summer, and it really was a stepping stone for him. He was on his way, really, when he left Eau Claire.
And did well.
Yeah, I think he acquitted himself.
Did fairly well, yeah. On the phone with Jerry Poling, he's with the Communications Department at UW Stout, former newspaper sports writer, has penned several books, A Summer Up North, Henry Aaron, The Legend of Eau Claire Baseball, Downfield, Untold Stories of the Green Bay Packers, After They Were Packers. Are legends accessible? Do they like people writing about them?
For the most part, I had very good, very positive reactions from the Packer players, ex-Packer players that I interviewed. Hank Aaron was a little bit tougher just because he's had so much media attention throughout his life. But he was very cooperative. Talked to him several times on the phone and interviewed him when he came to Eau Claire one time. You know, he's probably a little bit more skeptical of what this next book or story going to be about him compared to the average ex-Packer maybe who's been out of the limelight for 20 or 30 years. But but most of the ex-Packers that I interviewed were really very nice, and I think they were more than flattered than anything that somebody had remembered them and wanted to talk to them. Some of the guys were well-known, you know, Bart Starr, Ray Nitschke, Jerry Kramer. But I think it actually was more fun interviewing some of the lesser-known players who had disappeared almost totally from the radar of football and Packer fans, and to see what happened to them and where they went 20, 30 years after their careers were over.
Had a chance to talk to Bob Uecker, have you?
I did talk to him briefly when I did the Hank Aaron book, and it was in Milwaukee. And it was actually in between stints on the radio during a Brewers game. You know, usually it's on the air for a couple of innings and then off the air for a couple of innings. Mm-hmm. And so I caught him in between. Then we talked for a little bit in the media box at Old County Stadium before the Miller Park was born. So, you know, it was a lot of fun. He, like Hank Aaron, has just a lot of fond memories of Eau Claire, not only of the guys he played with, but just that time in baseball when guys played not for money, but they played because they simply just loved the game, and they all had that dream of getting to the majors. And kind of a golden era, what I can find when I look back in history, was the 1950s, 40s, 50s.
I mean, that's what you usually find when you talk to former professional athletes. They're either one of two kinds. They're either one that isn't doing well living as a non-legend or a past legend, or they have a wonderful perspective on what it was they really had.
Yeah. You know, some of the ex-Packer players that I interviewed, it was really, really fun to see what their memories were of Lambeau Field and Green Bay. But it's also more interesting to see what became of them. So many times, I think, with professional athletes, we have one-dimensional views of them. And that's simply, you know, what are their stats? How big are they? What's their number? When you think of it, Green Bay Packers, for example, there's probably only a few that stand out where you know a lot about them as an individual. And Reggie White would be one of them because he was so vocal about his Christian faith. And you felt like you actually knew Reggie White when he was playing. But there aren't too many Packers, for the most part, where you can say that, where you think you really have a sense for where they came from, what motivates them, what are their interests beyond football, what would they have done for a career if they hadn't been a football player. Yeah, that was really one of my goals with those stories I did about former Packer players is really to find out when they look back, what did it mean to them, what did it mean to their life, and also, you know, who really were they, what motivated them, what got them into football, and what were their interests, what type of person really were they. They were really, really fascinating people who did really interesting things beyond football after their careers, became police detectives, firefighters, became teachers, doctors, lawyers. I mean, just fascinating careers that you would never think would have come out of some guy who kicked a ball or blocked a guy on the line for a living. But football was over, and they had to do something, so they found another career. Yeah. You know, and for the most part, most of the Packer players from the 50s, 60s, 70s, and maybe partway into the 80s did not make big enough salaries so that when their careers were over, they could simply retire in luxury. They had to go get another job. But starting around the late 80s, the contracts got big enough that many of them, when they retired, could choose what they wanted to do, maybe start a business or just retire. And
play golf.
Yeah, play golf. Yeah.
There you go. So now you're taking kind of a 45-degree angle, and you're going to be writing about university history.
That's right. I'm working on a history about the University of Wisconsin Stout. University's sesquicentennial, the 125th anniversary of the founding of Stout, will be in 2016. So busy trying to piece together the 120-plus years of history here. It's fun to be able now to walk down through campus and know the names behind all of the halls. I know that James Stout's original building for the university sat on this spot, those types of things. I know when this building went up and why it went up.
Yeah, you have a wonderful resource in your archives department.
You know, the great thing about them is they are not only university archives, but they're an area research center. So they serve not only UW Stout, but they serve this region as far as genealogy, you know, just information about the community and the region. So much material is archived there, and it's just a great resource for anybody in this region willing to know about Dunn County, Upton County history.
Well, Jerry Poling, thanks for spending time with us. I appreciate it, and I will expect a UW Stout history book right hot off the presses.
Thank you. Enjoyed being on the show.
You bet. Jerry Poling, P-O-L-I-N-G, books about Hank Aaron's early years and the time he spent in Eau Claire, a couple volumes about former Packers. He's also co-authored a couple books about Wisconsin's public golf courses. Yet to come, a history of UW Stout. Speaking of yet to come, a documentary produced by a flock of former Chippewa Falls Cardinals. You know, there's lots of sidemen out there who make great music or help someone famous make great music who don't get the spotlight. Dave Nachmanoff is a guitar player primarily, and Saturday night he'll get the spotlight at the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls. He's done a lot of music, even custom songs for weddings or birthdays, but don't let that fool you. His most notable consistent gig is that of right-hand guy to Al Stewart, a Scot who had some good albums and at least a couple hits back in the 70s, namely Year of the Cat and Time Passages. Remember those? Right now, Dave Nachmanoff is on tour as a solo act, and as such, he's the focus of this segment, and he called in from the road. This is one of those interviews, they come along every once in a while, one in which I don't really know where to start, and who knows where it'll end up.
That's okay. I don't really have an agenda either, so we'll see what happens.
I think they missed the boat when they came up with the term Jack of all trades. It should have been Dave of all trades. I mean, at least musically. You play a whole bunch of instruments, although I see guitar is usually your photo mate.
I guess I'm probably known a little more as a guitarist, but I do play quite a lot of other instruments too.
Yeah, and you've played with a whole bunch of people. You play all over. You even offer to play for guys like me who have a sentimental streak and offer a song to a friend on her birthday, for gosh sakes.
I do custom songs, that's true.
Wow.
That's actually one of my favorite things to do. It's an amazing way to be part of people's lives in a tiny way and do something really personal.
You know, most people are busy and they covet their time off. You don't mind being busy. You're a busy guy. The old tale about someone living out of a suitcase, that seems to be you. Has that always been the way for you?
Well, it's particularly true these last couple of months. It's not always that true. I do actually get some time at home. This is just a particularly long tour. I've been gone from October 1st, was when I left, and the first show on this run was in Germany. I've been through, I think, four or five different countries and numerous states, and I don't get home till November 24th. So this has been an insane fall. On the other hand, I was home for most of the summer, very few out-of-town gigs. Just more time in the studio. So it does vary. Mm-hmm. I've been touring since 1997, so I guess it is kind of a way of life at this point.
So where is home for you?
Davis, California.
Okay,
cool. Sacramento.
Is there one occasion or one phenomenon you remember that threw cold water on you and you realized that music was going to be your life's work?
Gosh, no, there have been some wonderful little opportunities that came my way. I guess one of them was when I was 9 years old. Through a series of funny little accidents, I wound up meeting Elizabeth Cotton, the woman that wrote Freight Train, Little Cotton, and she invited me to perform with her. So I actually played on the grounds of the Washington Monument, and that wound up finding its way into a song some years later that I wrote called Kindred Spirits about that experience. And she was 82 at the time. You know, that was definitely a pivotal moment because it kind of made the light bulb go off. Like, wow, this is really something I would like to do. But you know, there have been a lot of moments like that. I guess I met Peter White, who was Al Stewart's guitar player at the Royal Albert Hall in the mid-80s, by pretending like I knew him. I talked my way backstage, and he was very nice and didn't have me thrown out. And I told him, and I wasn't us making it up. I said, you know, if you ever need a sub, I could fill in for you because I know all your parts. And he laughed and gave me a backstage pass and sent me on my way. And 10 years later, he remembered that conversation after a show in San Francisco and invited me to sit down and jam with him for a minute. And I got a call 4 days later inviting me to come down and audition for Al. And I didn't actually get the job right then, but that led to the beginning of the relationship that I built with Al. Eventually, a couple of years later, I did start touring with him.
I read that about you somewhere, probably on your website, or maybe it was someone's comment that you really have the uncanny ability to just, you know, sit down next to somebody and start playing what they're playing.
Well, I guess I did a lot of theory and ear training in college, and I've been playing since I was 8 years old, and to me, music is kind of like a language. You develop a fluency I guess it's the 10,000 hours thing. It's just enough time playing that, for the most part, I mean, I can't sit down and play bebop or Coltrane or something like that without having ever heard it, because it's not really my genre.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's kind of, you know, folk, rock, blues, country, that sort of thing, most songs I can kind of figure out where they're going to go as we're rolling along. So I used to go to a lot of music festivals, and people would sort of drag me up on stage to play with them, and sometimes people I'd never met, and certainly songs I'd never heard, and I was always pretty comfortable doing that, which is a good skill to have playing with Al Stewart, because the way our show works, it's usually, you know, just the two of us playing acoustic guitar, and a lot of times he doesn't even use a set list. So he'll just launch into something and expect that I'll follow him, and I usually do.
Hmm.
You know, I'm pretty comfortable with that. It doesn't throw me too much.
Uh-huh. Do you have a favorite guitar that you use?
Well, I've been touring now since 2003 with a Martin 00028EC, which is the Eric Clapton model.
Okay.
Same one he used on the Unplugged Element, and it served me beautifully. I actually bought it after a bunch of other guitars I had were stolen, including another Martin. It's been a great act. I've certainly played some other guitars that I've coveted, but I don't think I could do a whole lot better than what I've got right now.
No, that's an impressive model.
It sounds great because it gets so much use. Mm-hmm. And guitars improve with use.
Sure.
Loosens up the glue and the wood and everything, and they vibrate better. So you really have to play them. If they sit in a closet, they just stay tight.
The same person I was talking with earlier about the custom songs that you produce, we were also espousing how much a difference new strings makes. How often does a guy like you change strings?
I'm embarrassed to say I change them for every show.
You do? Okay.
Yeah, because the strings are a huge part of the sound. And unfortunately, I wear strings out fast. Pretty much by the end of one night, they're toast.
Wow.
So I get them in bulk, because it does seem incredibly wasteful to just use one set of strings once. But since it is such an important part of the sound, I feel like, you know, I'm not really going to be happy playing on dead strings.
Well, that's interesting. I don't know if I expected that. And then again, I think part of me did expect you to say that. So that's pretty cool. We're talking with Dave Nachmanoff. He is a singer, songwriter, guitar player. He's coming to the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, Saturday at 7:30 p.m. I can envision people after or while you and I are chatting going online and saying, you know, man, I remember the 70s. I remember Year of the Cat. I remember Time Passages. I'm going to go take a look. I think the same thing's going to happen to them that happened to me, because I kept looking at your photos on your website and saying,
right.
Okay, so where's Al Stewart? Because he looks a lot different.
Well, we all look a lot different than we did in 1970s.
That's true. But he's a blonde. He's a kind of a blonde guy now.
Yeah, more gray, kind of like brown and
gray.
Oh,
is it gray? Okay. If you watch the original video of him or some YouTube thing of him on stage.
Long, dark hair.
Yeah, no kidding. So the thing that you do with him is an acoustic evening with Al Stewart, yes?
Right. Generally, we play as a duo, and he's been very generous about usually having me open the show, so it's been a great way for me to get my own music out to a larger public. And
mm-hmm.
And he's actually on probably four or five of my albums.
Okay.
At this point, so we've collaborated quite a bit, and he's been a great mentor and an inspiration and teacher. You know, I've done my own thing.
Knowing all the variety that you have surrounding you, what kind of a show can one expect when buying a ticket to see Dave Nachmanoff? You've got a pretty big grab bag to grab
That's
from.
True.
Yeah.
Well, my belief is that really music shouldn't be too limited by genre. So while I definitely come out of the folk tradition, there's certainly elements of rock and maybe even a little bit of country to what I do and pop. And I like variety a lot. It's not the sort of show where every song sounds like every other song. I also am a pretty big believer that people come to a concert to be entertained, which means if you're just going to stare at your shoes all night and, you know, mumble a few words between songs, you probably shouldn't be on the stage without being too harsh about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people have lots of entertainment choices, so I feel like if they're there, they're there to be entertained. So I try to do a mix of things. I always say, as a songwriter, if the song provokes somebody to laugh, you know, that's great. I try and do at least a few songs that are funny or clever, hopefully. If they provoke somebody to cry and they move somebody to tears, then again, I'm doing my job. I made them feel something. If it provokes them to think or see something in a new way, that's a good thing. I have a background, I guess a somewhat dubious background in academia.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually Dr. Dave, and I used to teach philosophy before I became a full-time musician. So, you know, I do like to sneak a little bit of thought into the songs as well. So I always say those are the kind of three things I look for. If the song, you know, moves people to either laugh or cry or think.
I was thinking while you were talking about applause, and applause is many times something that just happens because someone realizes the song is over. You know,
right.
Applause should come from the heart. It should say, yeah, you know, I'm applauding. I'm clapping my hands because I like that. And to give you an idea of what audiences like, Dave would like to give you a taste of what it is he does.
My most recent album is probably my favorite.
Yep.
The one's called Step Up. The opening track was one that I wasn't so wild about when I first wrote it. And then when I sent the demos to the producer, he really loved that track. And it wound up being the lead track on the album. It's called Fragile Thing. Kind of a portrait, and it's really kind of about a woman who has, well, we don't really know, but something in her past that's kind of hurt her before, and she's met this guy, and she's kind of trying to figure out whether she can trust him or not. But he is very gentle and kind with her. Maybe this one's going to be different.
Jeannie cries easy. Doesn't take much to set her off. Steven seems to know how to calm her down. China, walking on eggshells most of the time. He treats her gently, she thinks she'll keep him round. She's a fragile thing, a complicated angel with a heart of glass, checkered past. You must be careful. She's a fragile thing, but this fragile thing will break your heart. She's a fragile thing, but this fragile thing will break your heart.
I think you're going to like the Heidi Center. It's a very intimate surrounding. It's ornate and yet very homey. Sounds kind of like it fits you well.
And if there is a piano at the Heidi Center, then you know I may use that for some of the show too.
Ah, well, be sure to let Deb Johnson know that you should have one close by.
If there is one handy, just because, you know, it makes the show a little more interesting.
I think there's one just off stage. I've done a show there, and I think there's one pushed into the wings.
There you go.
That could work. Dave, thanks so much for checking in from Massachusetts, and travel safely, and it's been fun getting to know you a little better. We like your music. Let us know whenever you're back in Wisconsin, will you?
Thanks very much. Well, I'm really excited, and I hope some people will come out.
I've got your personal cell number now. You're in trouble.
There you go. All right.
All right, Dave, thanks.
Great to meet you. Thanks, Al.
Dave Nachmanoff, Heidi Center for the Arts, Chippewa Falls. Tickets, cvca.net. That's online. Phone 726-9000. And I'm sure you can get them at the door. Saturday night.
Support for WPR comes from Brent Douglas Flowers and Artist Gallery, providing floral arrangements, plants, and gifts in the Eau Claire area. Fresh flowers are hand-arranged for every occasion, including birthdays, weddings, funerals, and just because. More at brentdouglas.biz. Support also comes from A Second Opinion magazine, dedicated to local alternative health and wellness. The current issue provides tips for an eco-friendly and local Christmas and gift ideas. Details are available at asecondopinionmag.com.
Let's do a little cha-cha here. Sunday at the Wide Spot PAC in Stockholm, it's Going Coastal, the variety show, 7 p.m. Info at widespotperformingarts.org. The UWBC Communiversity Symphonic Band presents their fall concert Tuesday the 19th, 7:30 p.m. in the UW Barron County Fine Arts Theater in Rice Lake.
Here's what's on stage in Western Wisconsin theater venues. River Falls Community Theater will stage Once Upon a Mattress Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and next Friday and Saturday at the River Falls High School Auditorium. A Carol of a Christmas will play weekends and selected weekdays at Fanny Hill Dinner Theater in Eau Claire. The show runs through January 12th. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild will present The Diary of Anne Frank through Sunday at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. Escanaba in the Moonlight, a production of the Northern Star Theater of Rice Lake, will play through Saturday. Theater in the Woods will present The Odd Couple through Sunday at the Erica Kwam Memorial Theater in Shell Lake. and White Christmas will play Fridays and Saturdays at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. The show runs through December 1st. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. I'm Jim Oliver.
Now, go ahead. You know, feel free to dance wherever you are, unless you're driving, of course. This is Spectrum West, Al Ross here, November 14th, a Thursday. It's called The Entertainers. It's a feature-length documentary, and its area premiere is in Chippewa Falls Sunday and Monday. It's produced by a group of Chippewa Falls High School grads, Paul Hogseth, Seth Hedrington, Derek Kayeski, and Nick Holly, plus co-directed by Holly and Michael Zimmer. It's won several awards at several film festivals, and after watching it, I can see why. You can hear me enthuse about it on a phone call with Nick Holly just yesterday from his home in Madison. Well, congratulations. It's kind of a neat film. I want to dig into this a little bit, though.
Sure.
Here's my personal opinion. It's the revelation aspect of that film that makes it so special. I mean, there's a certain faction of society that would have to be dragged kicking and screaming in front of a DVD player after being told they were going to watch a 90-minute film about ragtime piano playing. But, you know, if they allow themselves to remain in their seats, they're going to find, whether they admit it or not, that they're caught up in the suspense of it all and rooting for their favorites, all of whom were very nicely introduced. How's that for a take on the film?
That sounds about right, I think. Because I think our initial feeling was, okay, we're going to make a movie about ragtime. People can still play it. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of unsure of what that would be like. Mm-hmm. And when we kind of finally met these people and realized how passionate they were, how much they wanted to win the contest that they're playing in, really showing us their heart and their sense of the humor, mm-hmm. I think that was like, okay, yeah, we're definitely going to make a movie about this.
Here's some guys sitting around, and they may have the background to do this kind of thing, and they say, you know what we ought to do? Let's do a documentary. Why does ragtime piano playing even come into the discussion when there are so many other things that one could possibly do a documentary about? Are any of you involved in it? Have you met people? Do you hang out with them or what?
Yeah, so we had a little bit of personal connection to this. Okay. Michael Zimmer, a friend who I met through in grad school mm-hmm. in Los Angeles, he went to high school with one of the stars of the movie, Ethan Usland.
Okay.
They had always been good friends, and Ethan had always been this really great piano player. He was a classical pianist in college, just kind of made this transition to this early jazz, this ragtime music. Ethan was the one who was kind of like, make a documentary about this. This is a great subject. And I think we were, like I said before, a little bit skeptical at first because we didn't really know what it was going to be like. Mm-hmm. And so we decided one year to kind of take a few cameras and go and see what the weekend in Peoria was like. And that's when we were kind of like, wow, this is pretty amazing and funny and kind of weird and yeah. awesome. We should really do this.
Well, I'm kind of skeptical about a weekend in Peoria anyway.
I understand. But it is kind of a really cool event. It takes place in this old hotel. They, you know, are getting people in, these enthusiasts for this old music from all over the country. Mm. And it's kind of been rolling along for 40 years. They've had it. This upcoming contest will be the 40th.
Wow.
One of my friends there once said, you know, it just kind of, once you start coming, it gets in your bones.
Uh-huh.
And it's a great time to be in Peoria, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, and it gets in your bones even though you don't want to admit that it's there. I mean, I have to think that it was the relative obscurity of ragtime piano playing that attracted you, yes?
Well, I think so. I think it's the fact that, you know, people don't usually, you know, aren't usually still kind of thinking about ragtime. It's not our kind of collective consciousness right now.
Yeah.
But it's fantastic music. A lot of it sort of gave birth to jazz and rock and roll, and it's kind of part of our American roots. I think that was a big attraction. You know, I knew who Scott Joplin was, and I knew a few tunes that, you know, are kind of popular, Maple Leaf Rag or The Entertainer, but everything else is so amazing as well. Kind of going and exploring that was pretty fun.
On the phone with us is Nick Holly. He's the producer and director, along with other guys, of The Entertainers, a documentary about ragtime piano players and what turns out to be their Super Bowl. The regional premiere is Sunday at 1 p.m. and again Monday at 7 p.m. at the Micon Cinemas. And that is in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. Tell me, Nick, about the process of picking the six individuals whose quests we follow in the film. I know Ethan. I know where he comes in. Now, where did the other guys come in?
The first year we went down there, which is actually a year before the movie takes place.
Okay.
We kind of got to meet everybody. You know, everybody who competes is very talented, and they all have this unique shared love. And I think once we got talking to people, we kind of wanted to take people who came from different directions and people who are really able to articulate, you know, how much they love the music. Some of the people who are going to be real contenders mm-hmm. to win the contest, and also people who just had like differing backgrounds as they were growing up or the city where they're coming from. And I think that was kind of the main draw for these six particular people.
I mean, what an eclectic group they were.
Very much so. I mean, you have Adam Swanson, who at the time was a junior in high school, kind of a young phenom who was ready to take over the whole contest.
And didn't care about getting a driver's license at that age. I mean, go
exactly.
figure. Yeah.
And Faye Ballard, who has basically grown up with the contest. She started playing in the second contest mm-hmm. When she was 12 years old. Professor Bill Edwards is kind of the curator of this whole music. He's got this exhaustively researched website and books and basically a museum of ragtime in his house. So it came from all sorts of angles.
Yeah, no kidding. And Jim, he was an interesting guy.
Yeah, Jim Boston is from Omaha, and he's led a very difficult life,
mm-hmm.
and it hasn't always been a happy life, and in some ways lives a very solitary life when he's kind of at home and working, but he has got like one of the biggest hearts mm-hmm. of any person you'd ever meet. He loved coming to the contest. It's one of his favorite things, and he's got kind of an encyclopedic mind of old music, of basically of any genre, but he loves to get in front of on the stage and play piano. Everybody knows like how affecting and how much heart he brings to playing and actually just being even a fan
yep.
At the contest.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you want a role model for maintaining a positive attitude, Jim would be the guy.
You got that right.
You know, the interesting thing about how this film hooks you is I can tell you that I watched the first hour of it late at night, and then because I got tired, I had to shut it down. And then I found myself anticipating picking it up in the morning to see who won.
It is pretty riveting. I think one of the things we weren't quite sure of when we were making the movie is, you know, these people, they really, really want to win, but they're very nice people. There's not any real, like, outward conflict.
Sure.
But when you're sitting at the contest and being around them,
mm-hmm.
and you can kind of pick up on how much they want to win, and the intensity kind of builds with their silence a mm-hmm. lot of times, and their pacing, and their deep breaths, it's really kind of riveting once
yeah.
you get down to it.
It is. You ride the roller coaster with them. I mean, you really do. So congratulations on shaping the film in such a way as to engage the audience. Was that a tough part of planning the project, or did all of that engagement sort of evolve naturally as the filming went on? I mean, did you see this at the beginning?
We definitely saw the potential, and
okay.
I think, like, as the movie unfolds and the kind of tension, I think that was kind of the general feeling of people who were actually at the contest that year, too.
Mm-hmm.
Shaping the movie was incredibly difficult. Both Michael and myself are first-time documentarians, so we were kind of figuring it out as we were going along in a lot of ways. We ended up with between 250 and 300 hours of footage when all was said and done.
Wow.
And that was a massive, massive task to go through that and kind of whittle down these moments into the most important ones.
In reading the credits, I see you did have a lot of help and you had a lot of support as well. Hmm?
Yeah, absolutely. We had a team of producers and people who were along for filmmaking, five or six of us, you know, for the actual shoot at the contest. We had a great crew of 15. Through this whole process, we've kind of brought in support and help from, you know, a lot of fans of ragtime, obviously, of course, our family and friends, but
mm-hmm.
people really got excited about the process of making a movie on this contest, especially you know, the people who have spent their whole lives and volunteered their whole lives into kind of keeping this music alive and on people's consciousness.
And in the category this film was made possible by, there is a Russell Wilson.
Yeah.
Now, if one lives in Madison, one knows who Russell Wilson is, but I am guessing it's not the same Russell Wilson.
It is not the same Russell Wilson. okay. In fact, but Russell is a wonderful piano player. He's actually a contender every year that he plays in the contest.
Okay.
He's actually in the president's own Marine band and plays piano at the White House for a living.
Wow.
at parties and things like that. He was going to be our seventh person we were going to follow for the movie, but unfortunately for us, but fortunately for him, he had a baby that was born the week before the contest that year, so he wasn't able to make it.
So that's a more important gig there for him.
Yeah.
Well, Nick Holly, way to go. It's a lot of fun. And to the people out there who are saying, why would I go see a documentary about ragtime piano playing? Because Al and Nick told you to. And Al is the guy who didn't expect to become so involved in it and became involved in it. And I have a feeling that everyone who goes to see it or buys it, if they can't go this weekend in Chippewa Falls, will get involved as well. It's a lot of fun. Way to go.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Al.
There is a website. It's theentertainersmovie.com. And remember, you will be pleasantly surprised if you go to the word is surprise, Dale. If you go to the Mikon Cinema in Chippewa Falls, either Sunday at 1 p.m. or Monday at 7 p.m. I mean, has Uncle Al ever steered you wrong? Let me know if you go and decide I'm all wet about this, because I don't think that's going to happen. That wraps it up for Spectrum West for today. Here's a memo. Friday evening, 7:30, the opening of the annual display of quilts by members of the Apple River Quilt Guild, and Saturday at 7:30, a young performer's concert. That's at 7:30, both at the Northern Lake Center for the Arts in Amory. Wanted to get that in for you. Thanks, Rachel Vick, Tiffany Coggins, and Jim Oliver for priceless contributions to this effort. And plan to be with us next Thursday morning. We're going to talk Big River Radio Wave. Comedian Mary Rolls will be here. Some notable holiday treats for you. Catch this chapter again of Spectrum West Friday evening at 7 on the News and Classical Music Network stations of 89.7 and 90.7. Al Ross, thanks very much, everybody.